Dirk Durham, welcome to the podcast, my friend. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me on today.
Yeah, brother. So let's start with the size of this sack that you advertise on your YouTube channel.
The one that I keep all the presents in, like Santa
yes,
Claus, right?
That one, the Santa
that,
Claus.
That sack.
That's exactly right. So I think everyone knows who you are. I'm just going to go under that assumption. One of the things that I thought was interesting in listening to, I think, the Western Huntsman, as well as your last Cutting the Distance podcast, was conversation around etiquette and some of the stuff that, I guess my question to you is, how much of that do you think is existing hunters that don't have the same level of etiquette, you know, as maybe you've seen a generation ago, versus the people that have just started hunting, the late onset, I guess, is what you're tagging people.
Yeah, I think, you know, I've seen kind of bad etiquette from other hunters my whole life. So I don't think it's just the new adult onset hunter, if you will. But I do think, you know, it's out there. It's everywhere. And you know, maybe sometimes competition. People feel like hunting is a competition, and competition will bring out the worst in people. I know if you've ever been to a softball game or a basketball game in the gym, and there you'll see some nice folks from the community. You recognize maybe some quiet lady or a quiet man, and they get into a gymnasium where they're rooting for their favorite player or team, and the competition will bring out it'll bring out the beast in people, which and maybe that's kind of where it is in the elk woods or the deer woods. People are feel like they have to try or compete against other hunters to make sure they get their own meat to take home or whatever, and sometimes that's not a pretty sight. But I feel like there's a lot of maybe adult onset hunters who just haven't had that mentorship, maybe, or people to kind of get show them the way of like, hey, you know, this is how you act in the woods, and this isn't cool, and this is cool. And I kind of like to take it for that. You know, I feel like maybe, you know, sometimes people just haven't been taught the right way, you know, and since I have the opportunity to get on a podcast here and there and kind of talk, and maybe I can kind of help spread that message, you know, kind of do the right thing. And, you know, whether it's that or maybe seminars or just talking to people face to face, you know, I think we just all got to kind of spread that word of be good to each other and kind of golden rule type stuff. You know, there's a lot of, I mean, we could sit here and talk for hours about etiquette in different instances, but I feel like the golden rule applies, you know, do unto others what you'd have done to you. You know,
what do you think?
You can't go wrong that way.
Yeah. What are the most common mistakes that you see, you know, the late onset guys making, just from the standpoint of, you know, the etiquette thing, or just maybe just not even doing the right thing when they're out there in terms of the way it impacts other hunters?
Well, I think maybe they will maybe crowd in on other hunters. You know, they don't stop and pause for a second and think, you know, yes, this is public land. Absolutely. We all have the right to be out there, but they don't take a moment to pause and think, well, you know, gee whiz, I don't know if I would appreciate someone trying to get between a bull elk and me that I'm trying to get, or a deer or a turkey or whatever it is.
Do you think that they're doing it purposely, or do you think that they, in many situations, are doing it due to a lack of knowledge, just in terms of, you know, what the space should be? Because I guess the reason I ask that is, you know, being an East Coast guy where we're all sitting in trees by and large and working smaller pieces of property, and then, you know, this is my first, you know, Western hunt coming up this fall, but just the vastness of it and really getting your arm, you know, somebody like me or somebody who hasn't done it before, getting their arms around what we would think would be a ton of space, but really isn't a ton of space when it comes to probably hunting elk or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think maybe no fault of their own, just like you kind of pointed out there, people may not understand or acknowledge that, you know, what an ample amount of space is, right?
Right.
For us folks who live in the West, who have grown up in the West, you know, hunting for the last 30 years or something, you know, we used to enjoy a time of, you know, you go to the woods and if you broke down in your pickup or if you hurt your leg or something out on a trail somewhere, you were in real serious trouble because nobody was probably going to come by because there was not a lot of people in the woods at that time. Fast forward today where there's a lot more people in the woods, it seems like. It was kind of nice to have that freedom, right? We all kind of go hunting to escape society and escape all the modern conveniences of life. And and I guess a kind of perspective or, you know, how you see the world is kind of your reality to it. So if I've always thought, you know, if I could go out and not see another living person in 5 days,
right.
That's really good. That's good distancing. Whereas, someone from the Midwest or the East or South, that they're not used to that kind of, you know, solitary life, to where if they just don't see somebody walk up right under their tree stand that day, then they're pretty good. You know, maybe, yeah. Maybe the perspective gets a little skewed. So I feel like, for the most part, you know, the Western hunting experience, people are looking for seclusion. They're looking for solitary hunting. They're not looking for somebody angling to get in between them and their quarry purposefully. And I think that's kind of this perspective of folks who are just trying to get away.
Is that possible anymore to get that kind of seclusion? Is that doable with the amount of people that are coming out there? Is it, you know, can you go out for 5-7 days and not see anybody else anymore?
It depends on your level of physical fitness and maybe your mode of transportation. If you have horses, or maybe some kind of animals to pack all your gear and you can go deep, a lot of times, you know, depending on the state, you know, you can definitely do that, but you're going to have to go a lot further and a lot uglier, terrain features than you did 10 years ago, 20 years ago. That's for sure. And then depending on, you know, the area and the people going there, you know, you may see another person, like, you know, it's not a big deal if you see somebody across the hillside somewhere else, you know. But, and a lot of times, you know, depending on people's effectiveness when they're hunting, mm-hmm. You know, some folks, they're still learning. They don't understand how to hunt. They don't understand how to navigate the country. So they may just walk out a trail and sit next to the trail and watch for a while and then walk back to their camp. Whereas some people get out and get off trail and beat around the brush a lot. So I just kind of feel like, you know, it's just, there's a lot of different ways to experience it, but I feel like there is opportunities to get out there and get away from people. You're just going to have to use a lot more boot leather and sweat and blood to get to those kind of places for sure. I always say the older I get, the harder I'm having to hunt. I did not hunt this hard when I was in my 20s. I can promise you this.
Yeah.
I hunt super hard compared to what I did in my 20s. And for a couple factors, you don't know what you don't know, right? So when I was in my 20s, I didn't know what I know now. Mm-hmm. Whereas now I know what it takes to go to these places. But also I feel like we have to go to some more rugged country just to get away from people. So and I'm willing to do that. So, you know, some people are not, but I'm definitely willing to do that. And because I'm always, you know, I'm not just looking for the elk or the deer. I'm looking for a trophy experience. I just want to get out there and get away from people and enjoy some time. So,
yeah, I saw that film that you did, Ghost Bulls of the North, and that looked like some nasty country that you were jamming in right there.
Oh, yeah.
Is that pretty typical? Because that was Idaho, right? You live in Idaho.
I never did say on the film what state it was, but yeah,
it kind of looked like it to me, just based upon
Idaho.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that was some nasty terrain and you did that. How many days were you out there doing that?
I fit it into like a 3-day, scenario on the video, but it was a little longer than that. You know, if you take out the days of nothingness, you know, you have to make it watchable, right? So you take, let's say you have 5 days, you're there, and 2.5 of those days are nothing really happened. Nobody wants to watch that if you're trying to fit it into a 45-minute video. So, we're about there about 5 days, but we got 3 full days of good content. But I don't know how good it was. I mean, it was us walking through the brush, and there's some sketchy video of a bull or two there. But that's kind of the reality of hunting that kind of country. And sometimes I gravitate towards that stuff because, you know, there's maybe less elk and definitely less people that want to go there. Because it's not that fun to wade through that nasty brush and those steep hillsides and all that. I mean, there's a lot easier places to hunt definitely and have a lot more elk, but you typically find more people in those places too. So.
And how much of your hunting are you doing closer to home versus how much do you go do out of state, you know, out of state tags, traveling, that kind of stuff during a season?
I typically like to have at least one other state to go hunt in besides Idaho, just kind of depends on how the tags fall. You know, sometimes you're lucky to, you know, get a couple tags in, you know, in 2 different states in 1 year. And some years, you know, it's just, you're stuck to Idaho, but Idaho, if there's any non-resident elk tags left over after people turn them back in, residents can pick up those leftover tags. So I've been trying to pick up at least 2 tags a year in Idaho. That way I can bow hunt and I can rifle hunt as well.
So there usually are tags left over after that, after the initial, whatever, I don't know what you call it, a lottery or whatever they do in December, there is stuff left over.
Yeah. So once they first go on sale, all the tags usually sell out pretty quickly, but as we all know, life kind of happens and they have a period where people start turning tags back in. Let's say Idaho is the first on the list where you can buy an elk tag. So people gobble up the tags and then they put in to draw tags in other states. And then they draw tags in other states, you know, let's say, or maybe the state they live in or whatever, as far as non-residents go, and they end up getting a good tag, and they'll, you know, they have a limited amount of time, so they'll turn back that tag, or maybe they have life issues, you know, maybe family emergencies or whatever comes along, and they decide to turn that tag back in. And then after a certain date, I can't remember, I think it's midsummer sometime, I think it's July, maybe, they put those return tags back on sale for other non-residents or for the residents of Idaho to buy at the at the non-resident price. But what you'll find is if you're looking for one of those really good, hard to get tags where they don't offer very many of them, Idaho has these zones called capped zones. So they limit the number of tags they sell in those for resident hunters. Okay. So, and for non-residents in those zones, then I feel like they're very limited, very, very limited to how many tags they offer. So typically in a capped zone, for the most part, it's very good hunting. Now there are some exceptions. If you look at some of the units or zones on the map that are in areas that are very wolfy or very wolf infested, those cap zones, they're not limiting the number of tags because how awesome of a quality of a hunt they're trying to put out there. It's more of the elk are in really big trouble in that unit. So, they really want to limit how many tags will be sold.
This section of the podcast is brought to you by Osseo Gear. With its one-of-a-kind Raptor camo pattern, Osseo blends seamlessly into the whitetail woods. Its features and technology are designed specifically for the unique needs of bow hunters. I ran Osseo this past season, and from the 100-degree temperatures of the South Carolina swamps to the teens of the Illinois rut, Osseo has a system that covers you in every temperature. With 30 years of bow hunting experience, Osseo is backed by a lifetime guarantee. Use the code DONOTGO20 for 20% off the entire Osseo catalog. Find them at osseogear.com.
Gotcha.
And so the how what's the change in the wolf situation or the wolf population? Has it always been like that in Idaho, or is that relatively, is that something that's changed over the last 10 to 15 years?
So for we've always had wolves in Idaho, but the original wolves that were here didn't have a great impact on our large mammals, you know, our ungulates, deer, elk, moose population, really whatsoever. Bears back in those days probably had the biggest impact on, you know, on the spring births of calf elk, fawns and calf moose. You know, they were pretty hard on those animals, but wolves really didn't have any skin in the game. Really, there were wolves around, there wasn't a lot of them, but you'd see their tracks, you'd hear them howl from time to time, at least the area that I grew up in, Idaho. And at that time, back in those days, that was one of the most elk rich areas in Idaho. Then in 1995, they transplanted some Canadian gray wolves in Idaho, and within a few years, their population spread like wildfire. They,
what was the rationale for that?
They wanted to bolster or bring back the wolf. They wanted wolves to be commonplace in Idaho, because they're on the endangered species list. Correct. So they wanted to bring them back to Idaho and let them flourish, and they flourished really well. And then what happened was, you know, their initial transplant of these wolves in Idaho, they had a certain number of breeding pairs and a population. And once they reached that, then they would allow the Fish and Game Department to manage these wolves, their numbers, through hunting. But what happened was, is they got tied up in lawsuits, in court battles. Every time they would try to delist the wolf as being not endangered any longer, then these animal rights groups or whatever would sue the federal government and say, hey, you know, we need more research. We need to make sure these wolves are going to flourish. And if it's too soon to pull them off the endangered species list, basically. So that court battle went on for a decade until they finally got those lawsuits to kind of stop, and then they were allowed to manage them. Well, the folks of Idaho know this, but, you know, maybe the people on the outside don't, but, you know, it wasn't a massacre. As soon as those wolves came off the endangered species list, it wasn't a massacre.
They're hard to hunt, right?
They're very hard to hunt. They're very intelligent, and they live in country that's remote, rugged and brushy. So, you know, they're a lot shorter than an elk. So in brushy country, you may be able to see an elk on a hillside, you know, a long ways away. Well, wolves are small enough, they're short enough to where they go undetected. So until they let us start trapping wolves, then our wolf population continued to climb, and it was out of control. There was a time I feel like, in, you know, for me, with my experience in the woods, where I seen the most wolf tracks was probably 2007. There wasn't anywhere in North Idaho that I didn't go deer elk hunting that I didn't see wolf tracks in the road. They were everywhere, and it looked really, wasn't just like one or two. It looked like the whole packs of wolves were running up and down every dirt road in North Idaho. Fast forward, you know, our game became depleted. Wolves spread out looking for more food. Then I'm not sure on the dates, but then they started allowing us to trap them, and some of the folks started getting pretty good at trapping. And in the last, I don't know, 5 years or so, people have gotten really good at trapping them. So they've actually made a big difference on the growing numbers of wolves. They've kind of decreased the number in some areas and then kept them at bay in others. So that's the real valuable tool with wolf management, is trapping. But be that as it may, even with that, all that being said, they're still hard to catch. I mean, these guys are trying to catch wolves in the dead of winter, let's say, and you have to check your traps every 72 hours. So it takes a lot of commitment, time commitment, takes a lot of resources. You have to have a lot of money for fuel and a snow machine of some kind. And then it's not like you just set your trap and walk away and you're going to get a wolf in it every time. You talk to the wolf trappers and they'll go out on their trap lines and a big snowstorm will come in and snow over them and freeze them all open to where they'll have a wolf that'll step in it, but the thing's frozen, so it won't even go off. So it's not a perfect science by no means. The wolves still have the upper hand, definitely.
And why do they have to check them every 72 hours?
That's state law.
Oh, it's the law. Okay.
Yep.
Just so that they're not stuck there for however long or whatever if you get them caught.
Yeah.
Gotcha. From a humanity
perspective. Yeah, it's more humane that way. Uh-huh. Yep.
Makes sense. So have you, since the trapping started, has there been a noticeable resurgence in the herds? Are you starting to see that change in terms of the number of animals coming back, or has that remained a little bit stagnant?
In the areas I've been, I haven't seen a big resurgence of animals, definitely. I feel like it's going to take a lot of years because I feel like there's still wolves present,
right,
in a lot of these areas that I go. And I run a lot of trail cameras all summer, and I haven't seen like, wow, holy moly, there's a lot more elk on my trail cameras. In the last couple of years, in fact, that it's actually gotten worse than it was 4 years ago. And I don't know what the deal is with that. A couple of years ago, let's say 2, 3, 4 years ago, I didn't see as many wolf tracks in the mountains. This last year, this last summer, this last fall, I started to see more wolf tracks again in certain areas. So I don't know if those wolves are just had moved in from another area or what. But it's hard to say, unless you had collars to track them, to kind of understand their travel patterns. But wolves have a huge home range. They'll travel 20 miles a day easily, and search for food. So
what's worse, the wolves or the people from the East Coast who keep coming out there and hunting every winter in larger numbers or every fall?
I'll take the East Coast. No, I'll take you East Coasters any day over wolves because you guys are only here for 10, 15 days a year and wolves are here 24/7 and they're eating all they can in that time,
Yeah. So I heard, I would like to know, like, what is the general attitude towards just the more, all these people that are coming out and hunting out west more and more every year from, guys like you who grew up out there and really have enjoyed, kind of having that be your space. And now all of a sudden you're having to share a lot of it.
I think for me personally, it's situational, right? I don't mind seeing people in the woods that are respectful and they're just enjoying the natural resource just like I am, and they're respectful of each other. I don't mind that at all. What I do mind is people that aren't out there doing it right. They've got an axe to grind, or they think, this, I bought this $700 elk license and tag, and by God, this is my ticket to free reign of Idaho. And I don't have to respect people or respect the land or respect laws of, not to go behind locked gates with non-motorized gates or non-motorized trails. Those are the people that I have a real problem with. Mm-hmm. And I feel like just like anything, a few bad actors, kind of spoil it for everybody. Yeah. So those people will kind of stand out. Whereas the normal people, they kind of blend in and you never notice them, right?
Yeah.
But it's always the bad actors that kind of stand out and do some stuff that pisses everybody off.
Yeah. As you know, I live in South Carolina, and so we've had this proliferation of people since COVID from New York, New Jersey, all these northeastern states move down here. And kind of like you said, there's, most of them are moving down here to get away from what was up there and have a like-minded attitude. But every once in a while you'll see somebody in a grocery store or something that just acts like they're from New Jersey.
Oh, yeah.
And every time I see a New Jersey plate or a New York plate or something, that's all I think about is that person. So this is my first fall coming out there, but I'm super sensitive to making sure that I do it the right way. I'm trying to learn as much as I can. I'm going to, you know, either go guided or go with a friend that, that lives out there. Because I respect the way of life. I respect, you know, where you guys are coming from in terms of how long you've been out there. And I want to make sure that, that myself and hopefully other people, whether they listen to the podcast or they're listening to other podcasts, have that same respect when they decide to go out there for the first time and when they continue to go out there.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I like to hunt out of state, you know, in other states. And personally, I like to, you know, when I'm there, I want to have a very minimal impact. Mm-hmm. I don't want to have any disruptions with local folks or other non-resident people. I want to respect the land. I want to pack out my garbage. I don't want to, I don't want to, you know, make a mess where people are going to have to kind of walk around it. I mean, I don't know. It just, maybe it's just the way how I was raised. You know, I want to be good to other people and I want to be good to the land and it's all beautiful, beautiful public land, but it ain't mine. And I have to make sure it's as good or better than I left it. So I'm not going to disrespect the land or the local folks when I'm there. And I try to keep things under wraps. I don't want to, you know, when I'm hunting other places, I don't want to blast all over social media or maybe like, let's say we're filming an elk hunt. You know, cameraman Dusty, he's always instructed, we're not going to video any kind of beautiful landmarks or mountain ranges and stuff like that. Just because I don't want to, number one, if it's a great hunting spot, I don't want to blow it up for myself, definitely. Mm-hmm. But I don't want to blow it up for the local folks that have been hunting there for 30 years. And they're like, oh, gee whiz, ever since that jerk came up here hunting, everybody recognized the area. Yeah, everybody recognized the area and knows where to go. So, you know, I want to try to be as, you know, discreet as possible.
Yeah, that makes sense. So when, obviously this is something that's fairly new to me, but, and you've been visible to me since I started hunting, started paying attention to Western hunting, things of that nature. But when, I know you've been hunting your whole life, when did you start to kind of become visible on social media and those, you know, that kind of stuff? How did that whole thing happen?
Oh, well, my kids, they got social media first. They got the old Facebook. My wife and kids did. And
because your kids are like, what, in their 20s now?
Yeah, yeah, they're in their 20s. And must have been 2009, mm-hmm. I got Facebook. And, or they got Facebook. And I'm like, oh, Facebook, this is stupid. But then I kind of seen like, oh, well, you can connect with all like your old friends, like your old high school people or some of your old workmates or teammates or something like that. Oh, that's kind of cool. So I'm like, you know what? I'm going to do it. So got on there on Facebook and reconnected with people I went to school with. And it was cool because you could see, you know, their family and, oh, they had a baby or they have a grandbaby or whatever. And it was really cool. It's a good way to just kind of see, keep tabs on everybody. And then of course it's evolved a lot since then, as we know, but yeah. Then I think in 2012, I got Instagram. I'm like, oh, Instagram is way different than Facebook. Mm-hmm. It's more picture oriented. It's it's like you're sharing cool experiences and beautiful pictures and stuff like that. I'm like, oh, cool. I love pictures. Right. So
I had the same experience too. I was never like, I had Facebook, but I didn't really do much with it. My wife did.
Yeah.
But the minute I kind of got into Instagram, I was like, oh, this is like, I got a lot more hooked on that.
Yeah. So I watched other people share their beautiful photographs and their experiences behind that photograph, mm-hmm. you know, whether it's just a scenery pick and maybe some deep thoughts behind it. I really loved that. And I thought, oh man, I like that. I'm going to do that too. So I started sharing, on there and, you know, little by little over the years, you get more followers and you follow more people and Instagram has turned into now, it's like kind of a hybrid between TikTok and I don't know what, but it's a tragedy what's happened really. Cause it used to be really cool, but now it's just trying to be TikTok, which it's never going to be TikTok. I wish the people at Instagram would just be like, hey, let's go back to the way it was when photographers and artists and people like that could have a good time on there. It's just did a people building kooky funny reels or whatever. I mean, I enjoy the reels too. I mean, there's a lot of funny stuff on there. I get my daily kicks out of laughing at silly videos or whatever, but I do miss the old days when just a cool picture would do as well as a kooky video would.
Yeah, because nobody will look, even look at a picture anymore, hardly, right?
Yeah.
You just put a picture up and it's like people scroll by it, but
yeah. It's, and the algorithm, you know, is just, it doesn't show them to people, you know?
Yeah.
And whether it's your shadow banned or they're just not showing that kind of content to other people is crazy, you know?
Yeah. And I don't spend a ton of time looking at Instagram. Like I'll do my post or whatever and put it up. I spend a lot more time on YouTube. I think probably because it's really more of a search engine and I can look for specific things that I want to learn more about. That's, you know, kind of where I saw a lot of your stuff, honestly, was YouTube first, just as I was starting trying to do some research on, you know, calling and bugling and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, which one should I order? And so, I mean, that's kind of how I first found you was watching all your bugling stuff over on YouTube.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. I consume a lot of YouTube as well. I don't have normal cable TV or any of that. So I'm usually, you know, watching some short videos on YouTube or some kind, or, I use it a lot when I'm editing videos, 'cause I'm like, how do you do this one thing? And, you know, Adobe Premiere is a monster to tackle and try to figure out how to use, but you can leverage YouTube pretty well to learn how to do all the stuff on Adobe Premiere. So it's been a big tool.
Yeah. I actually just downloaded Adobe Premiere like last week. I'm starting to finally learn how to use it, because I was like, okay, I got to learn how to edit better other than, you know, chopping a piece out of the middle on an iMovie or something like that. You're right. It's super robust. The first time I like went through the first tutorial, I was like, okay, my head spinning in tutorial number one.
Yeah. I feel like there's like, people who are really good at using Adobe, you know, Adobe Masters. They're the same kind of people that are really good at like Excel. You know, they use it the right way, the way it was designed to be used. And then you got guys like me, when I use Excel, I'm like, I just made up my own way to use it. And I feel like it's probably the same with Adobe Premiere. I'm like, somebody that's like an expert would look how I do it and be like, dude, why are you doing it that way?
So are you editing all your own stuff? Like when you put one of those YouTube films out, is like, does Dusty do all that for you? Do you edit some of it yourself? Are you just editing your short stuff? Like, what are you doing on there?
No, I edit everything. Dusty, in the past, he's edited some stuff for us. We had a New Mexico film here in 2021.
Yeah.
When we hunted with Ryan Lampers and Jason Phelps, he edited that whole thing, but everything else I edit.
And all the sound and the graphics and everything, like you do all that?
Oh yeah.
It looks like you've kind of figured it out.
Well, I'm one of those people that, like I say, you learn how to do it the way you do it. And so I started editing videos way back on my phone. My very first videos, I edited on my cell phone. And then, I got a Mac.
Yeah.
Got a MacBook. I'm a
Mac guy. Yeah.
And then I used, iMovie to edit for quite a while until I outgrew it. Like if you watch my Mouth Tab Madness series of elk hunting on my personal YouTube channel on the Bugler channel, then I edited all that on the iMovie.
Okay.
And I grew out of that pretty quick. And now
that's kind of where I'm at now too, is I've kind of grown out of iMovie. Like I can't do the stuff I want to do at it. So now I'm staring down the barrel of Adobe.
Yeah.
Wide eyed and saucer eyed.
Yeah, it takes a little bit of time, you know, to break down the workflow, definitely. But once you kind of figure it out, it goes pretty quick. I've been editing a mountain lion hunt all day today, and it went quicker than I thought it would. So it was good.
So how do you have time to do all that between what you're doing at Phelps?
Oh, that's my job at Phelps.
Oh, that is your job. So
that is my job
is to make films.
My job is to, like, I do everything. I manage the social media at Phelps.
Okay.
I do all the content management, you know, whether I'm editing stuff. Here 2 weeks ago, I flew to Missouri and filmed. I got behind the camera and filmed our turkey guys, James Harris and Steve Morgenstern, about their new calls. I filmed them, turn and burn, got home, went to the trade show for a while, and then edited all that stuff, and then I think I did like 8 or 9 different videos out of that turkey content. I had to get edited for our turkey launch this spring. And then I'm still not done. I still got more turkey stuff to edit. And turkey stuff to edit's not my favorite. I like to hunt turkeys, but it's not elk hunting, right? So
right. I'm with you. So I mean, I don't know if maybe that part of Missouri is that like you can't say where you were. I've got family in Missouri. That's why I was wondering.
Oh, well, I flew into St. Louis, right. And I was about an hour south of those guys. So, and we didn't hunt or anything. We just filmed at their workshop.
Kind of south of Festus. Like, did you remember seeing Festus as you drove south? That's about probably 40 minutes south.
Yeah, I think I remember seeing that sign on the freeway. Let's see. What was the town? Is it, I'm just picturing the video I just could put on there because I put the title of the town there. One of the guys is from Kirksville, which is up north.
Oh, my wife used to live there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know that area. Mm-hmm.
And the other guy is just south of St. Louis, about an hour. What is it? It's Hillsboro.
Okay. Yeah, I know where that is.
Yep.
So I know that you're involved with some kind of a whitetail foundation in Idaho as well. So do you do a lot of deer hunting still, or is it like how much of that is your hunting time?
Yeah, I deer hunt every fall. Mm-hmm. You know, whitetail hunting in Idaho was my first love. Elk hunting was my second. Because my dad, you know, when I very first started hunting, you know, I was like, well, I'm not going to buy an elk tag. I'll just buy you a deer tag. And so that's where it all started for me. And back then, Idaho, our whitetails were huge. They were king. There was so many deer and there were mature bucks. There was lots of does that just, you could walk out anytime you wanted to go hunting. You'd walk out in the woods. And if you walked 100 yards in the woods, you would jump a deer. A deer would run off. You'd see a white flag, waving as it ran away.
It's not like that anymore.
No, it's not like that at all. It's there's times, like out on the public land, there's times you can spend all day out there. If you're walking and hiking and sitting and stuff, you may not see a deer.
Is it mostly predation or hunters or the, like just a change in the, like what's the cause of that?
There's lots of different, it's a multifaceted issue. You have predators, right? We have wolves that we didn't have before. We have blue tongue and EHD, epizootic hemorrhagic disease. We have those diseases. That's kind of new. I think the first year we had that, those was like 2005 or so. So back in the 80s and 90s, we never had that issue with the EHD and the blue tongue. You also have, back when growing up, all the timber country was mature around all the country you would hunt whitetails in. It was all mature, big, heavy timber. Not a lot of openings. If there was an opening, it was a meadow or maybe a farmer's field or something, okay, or a pasture. Today, fast forward, they've went through and logged all that stuff again. And so there's clear cuts, there's massive clear cuts. Mm-hmm. And I'm not against logging at all. It's a renewable resource.
Right.
But the fish and game hasn't taken steps to consider, you know, the change of habitat. So they've lost a lot of their security cover. You know, you have these massive clear cuts, you know, when let's say they did the first clear cut would be 600 acres and then they would make another one, you know, a half mile away, another 600 acres. But as over a, you know, 5-year period, they've all kind of cut everything in between. So now you have these clear cuts are 2 miles across. And during the whitetail rut, you know, bucks get pretty ruddy and they start following their nose, especially all night. Well, they wake up, they kind of come out of their daze just after daylight and they're in the middle of a 2-mile clear cut following a stinky doe track.
Yeah.
Well, not now they're vulnerable. Kill them, is it? Yeah. Yeah. Right. And they sell a lot of tags. So, you know, opportunity for tags, are there and people are, you know, opportunistic. They want to get a deer, you know, whether they're just for meat. Some people want to hunt for horns, but the reality of it is, you know, they're shooting too many deer. We've lost our age class between heavy harvest, disease in some parts of that, of the areas, and then definitely predation, you know.
Gotcha. So, well, so I know elk is your love, right? I mean, I heard the story about, I think it was when you were a kid and you went and sat next to a pond because you thought you were going to shoot a bear, right? And you saw some elk come in and you're like, that's what I want to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
So for somebody like me, you know, first time coming out, what are the top, let's say you're somebody, because a lot of people that listen to this are East Coasters. And if they're thinking about doing something like that, what are your top three pieces of advice in terms of preparation?
Number one, you have to have realistic expectations. What are your expectations? Are you wanting to do a backcountry backpack hunt where you pack in your bivy camp on your back and hunt, you know, like a lot of the YouTube guys do?
Is that even realistic for somebody first time out to do something like that?
Well, I feel like majority of people may not have the romantic experience that they they've got in their head, right? you're gonna learn a lot about yourself and limitations, and just certain areas are just not conducive to that. Now, let's say you're a fitness freak, and you're really good, you know. Muscular, you're very your cardio's in good shape, and you're pretty tenacious. You'll probably have a pretty good hunt. Now, will you kill something? Maybe, but I always say backcountry hunting is level 10 on the scale of difficulty. That's hard for everybody. That's hard for people who have been doing it their whole life or noobs. So if you're new, I would set your expectations like maybe the first time out there, maybe I don't want that. Maybe I want to try something that's a little easier. Maybe hunt some of the front country that's a little more accessible. It's got a little more roads. That way, if I burn myself out on the first day or two, there's other options to keep me in the game. But if you backpack in, you know, 4 or 5 miles with all your camp on your back, and most new people pack way too much stuff. You get up there and you blister yourself in the first couple of days, or you have altitude sickness. You're probably going to be sidelined for another day or two, just trying to heal up and get enough energy to hunt around. And that's kind of like a harsh reality of it. So if you hunt the front country, maybe the edge of the back country, maybe you could have the best of both worlds. You know, you can have, you know, some remote stuff. And then if things don't go like you hoped, maybe you can hunt some of the easier, more gentle stuff and still stay in the game without just being, well, crap, I'm sitting here staring at my blisters at my feet in camp all day today. It'll give you some options.
So if you're sitting there looking, you know, if you're e-scouting and, you know, and you're okay, let's say you're going to employ that strategy, then what are you looking at as you e-scout in terms of the kind of landscape, the kind of topography that fits that, you know, that middle ground, like kind of, you know, front country to the edge of the back country? What's the best way to scout that for somebody who's, you know, new and trying to figure that out?
Well, it's kind of the edge country, you know, that's, you look on Google Earth or on Onyx or whatever mapping software you like to look at. You look and see the road system and where there's lots of roads, and then where it goes turns to roadless. So somewhere along the edge of that roadless country would maybe be a good place to start, you know, that way you're not trying to drive on a road for 20 miles through roadless country and then hit a trailhead. And then, you know, you're deep at that point, you know, you're going to walk in 5, 6, 8, 10 miles, in the middle of roadless country already. Maybe you're going to hunt the edge of the roadless country. That way you have options. And you have to kind of be mindful of units too. So some game units are broken up by some of the units are more predominantly backcountry, roadless type country, whereas the other ones are more roaded. So,
roaded, are we talking paved roads or what's considered a road? Just like anything that's labeled a country road or has any kind of like a demarcation on it?
Trail? Yeah. You'll be looking at, the map and it'll show like, maybe there are roads that are, they're closed to pickups and like four-wheel drive SUVs and stuff. But like, if you're on Onyx, it would say, you know, four-wheel drive SUVs or whatever would go on them. Or maybe they're a gated road that you could take an ATV or a dirt bike or a horse. You know, there's a lot of those kind of roads. They're old logging roads, right? That where they've maybe it's private timber country or it's like state endowment lands that have roads in it that have been logged, but some of the roads are gated, some are not. That's where all the research comes into play. But if you kind of hunt close to both areas, you know, you could have best of both worlds, right? So if you wanted the backcountry or roadless experience, you could, you know, drive a little ways and get into those kind of places. And then if you wanted to take it easy and walk an old gated logging road, you know, for several miles and hunt that way, you could definitely do that too.
And so when you're doing that research, how does somebody find out whether, you know, that's a gated road that, you know, you probably can't get past with a vehicle versus something that is that marked on Onyx or Google Maps, or is that something that you have to call Fish and Game about?
So Onyx has some really good features on it. A lot of times it'll show gates on there, or if you just click on that road, it'll tell you like the designation of that particular, the road travel allowment. And then also if it's like a national forest, you can get on their website and kind of figure out where you're wanting to go, let's say that certain national forest, and you can even order like hard copy, like paper copy travel management maps that will show all the roads and trails in the area. And if they're roadless or what their designated use pattern is.
This section of the podcast is brought to you by Ridgeline Athlete. Don't let your physical preparation hold you back from finding success this season. You can train anytime, anywhere with a professional coach who brings decades of performance training and hunting experience to every session. And I think that is important. Ridgeline Athlete provides backcountry athletes with safe, highly effective training programs that are built for the demands of the backcountry. Use RA Do Not Go 30 to get 30% off any training program. You can find them at ridgelineathlete.com. Or hit up Adrian on Instagram at Ridgeline Athlete. Do you think those are useful? Like, do you like having a paper map versus on the phone? Like, is there ever a place where you think that's beneficial over having it on your phone?
It is. It's nice to have that paper map because sometimes, you know, your phone screen's this big.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's nice just to pull up, open a map, especially if you're a note taker and you're putting, if you did your stuff in the off season and you did some highlights and wrote notes and stuff on your map. Let's say you get stumped and your plan A, B, and C or your elk hunt is kind of fizzled out and you're like, well, crap, what am I going to do now? Well, you can always go to your map and start looking at the different places and be like, oh yeah, I kind of forgot about this one spot, which I mean, you can do that with your Onyx as well, but it's a little, you know, it's a little electronic handheld device and
scale.
And, you know, it's sometimes it's just easy to look at a big piece of paper with marks on it and be like, oh yeah. You know, if I'm going to go to a place, a lot of times I'll make a huge game plan, like A through Z almost. And sometimes I will print maps from Google Earth and like some areas. I'm like, okay, I want to hunt. I want to target this area. I'll print off a big, like 11 by 16 piece of paper with a Google Earth 3D map printed with all my little icons that I wanted, because it'll have a little different, it'll show terrain features just a little different than Onyx does, a little better sometimes, in my opinion. So I'll print those up, those hard copy maps. And then I'll even type in some like little game plan things on like certain drainages and stuff that I want to hit. And I'll have just a hit list, like, okay, day one, I want to hit this, 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 and this, and just go on throughout the whole hunt and almost have everything kind of laid out, like I'm going to hunt this place this day, this place that day, this place this day. And then just kind of have it all lined out. And then of course, when I get to the hunt, I'm always like, well, crap, that doesn't make sense now because there's no elk over here. I'm going to go over to try this other spot. And I always hit the same spots, or I hit the spots that I have written on my list, but it may not be quite the order that I had first initially anticipated. Just depends on what I find when I get there to hunt.
Yeah. So from a, just from a strategy standpoint, I know that there's kind of this, I heard you having a conversation and talking about the strategy of bugling versus kind of the spot and stalk. Do you think there's one that's a little bit more user-friendly for a newer, you know, elk hunter versus the other? Let's say just, let's just assume that, that you can call, that, you know, that you're decent enough to figure out how to call some and get some of the basic calls down. Just from us, once you get past that, do you think there's one that's more conducive to a new hunter out there?
I think you should always learn how to call, and call well. And for me, that's been how I've found 98% of my success is through calling, but there's nothing that will really replace good woodsmanship. Mm-hmm. And spot and stalk type of hunting tactics would be, very woodsmanship heavy, right? You know, navigating, you know, identifying your target and then getting over there efficiently before it moves. But what I do most of the time is once I locate them with my calls, I shut up and I try to get over there to them, you know, without calling all my way over there. So I'm going to use kind of the best of both worlds. So I'm going to try to pinpoint, and I hunt a lot of country that you can, if you can see across the drainage, because there's so many trees, then you probably wouldn't see an animal on the other side of it anyway. So you kind of just kind of have to kind of mark the sound just by, okay, I think it's over there by that big rock or whatever. I'm going to go ahead and make that.
There's not a whole lot of glassing going on in that area.
No.
Talking about. So you, kinda, you need to identify them through sound.
You need to identify them through sound. Mm-hmm. Now, if you want to hunt more open country where there's not very many trees at all, calling will take a back seat to more of the spotting. You know, mm-hmm. you're gonna want to get up high where you can see, you know, at first light and then last light of the day, and then kind of make your game plans from there. Now, it doesn't mean you wouldn't want to call in those kind of situations. You just have to get close, right? So it's like, oh man, there's a whole herd of elk over there, 3 miles away. I'm going to get over there and get close to them. And then it's real open terrain, right? So I'm not going to stand there, you know, 300 yards from the elk out in the wide open and try to call them to me in the open. What I'm going to do is wait until they get into a place where they can't see very far. Maybe they're tucked into a little ravine or a little bench with some scrubby trees and some brush or something. And maybe there's a little, you know, terrain feature that they would have to come walk over to see where that elk sound is coming from. Right. That's what I'm going to use to my advantage. I'm going to get super close, but I'm not going to make a sound until I get very, very close to where I know they're going to be within my effective range when they come investigate.
And do you like I guess it probably depends on the situation and the part of the season you're in, but how much do you cow call versus bugling? And do you like I've heard some people say they always start with a cow call first. Is that, what's your thought process on that? Or is it because you've been doing it so long, very, very specific to, you know, kind of what part of the season you're in and everything?
I've done both over the years. And I, every year is a little different what I try to start with, but sometimes I get lazy and I don't cow call before typically I want to cow call first. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I'll get lazy. I'm just like, I haven't had anything answer a cow call for 3 days. I'm not going to start out with a cow call. I'm just going to bugle. And then if I get an answer, then I will start using some cow calls and see how they react. So if the bull reacts to cow calls, if he answers when I cow call, if he bugles at the cow calls, I'll continue to use them. If he doesn't answer the cow calls, I won't completely quit using them, but I won't use them very much because for whatever reason, he's not real interested in that cow call, but he likes the bugle. So if he answers that bugle every single time and hasn't really answered a cow call, then I'm not going to go real heavy on cow calls.
And then if you're going to start with a bugle, is it always a locator bugle, or is it depend again on the situation, what kind of bugle you're coming out with?
it's all situational. And I don't think there's a right or wrong answer, honestly. I feel like it's almost like turkey hunt. You're just trying to, it's almost like a shot gobble, right? So It's almost like you're just trying to get it out there. Now, you know, if you want to dissect it and like be strategic and like, oh, you know, well, I don't want to have my first sound be, you know, aggressive or too aggressive for this one elk, you know, then yeah, I'm going to do just like a non-threatening locator bugle, just a high pitch, you know, it's one of those. But what I found over the years is sometimes bulls will answer that right away. Sometimes they won't answer until I give them a big, nasty, full lip ball bugle with a bunch of horrendous ground shaking, thunderous grunts at the end. And then they answer. So after, you know, I've made three or four different, definitely distinctly different bugles. Mm-hmm. So
they all have personalities. You're trying to get to see, I guess, figure out which guy you're talking to and what they respond to.
Yeah. You just never know what they're going to the bite on, honestly. Mm-hmm. So I always say elk calling, it's an experiment. You just never know what they're going to answer. And I want to throw enough stuff out there to where I get one to bite. And then once I figure out what he likes to hear, then I'm going to kind of tailor it to that. You know, there's people out there trying to sell you that, oh yeah, this, you do this certain call every time and you're going to call them right in. You can do
that's what I was asking. Cause there are people that say that.
Oh yeah. There's a lot of, you know, people in the elk hunting space that'll tell you that, but I'm not here to try to cause controversy, but majority of those people, I spend way more time, and I've spent the last 30 years with way more time calling elk than a lot of those people will that are selling those ideas. And I found the most consistent, the one call that works every time, there is none. The elk are so different. They're a lot like people. And you just have to figure out what they want to hear on that particular day. Now that bull, one day he may love cow calls, and you go back 3 days later and he won't answer a cow call, but he'll bugle his head off to a bugle, and you go back 3 days later and he won't answer any of them. Mm-hmm. So I've never found a silver bullet, call per se. I just know, but I do know that high quality sounding calls do work good, especially in areas where, you know, there's a lot of other hunters. So you want to sound authentic. So you want to be able to blow the best authentic sound and bugle. Now, does that sound perfect, like compared to the guy on YouTube doing it? Maybe not. Maybe it's not that. Maybe if you listen to real elk, they're authentic. They have a certain sound about them. So They're not that beautiful, it's just the textbook flawless bugle, right? There's a lot of bulls that sound really terrible, but if you're adding that emotion and that kind of authenticity to the sound, I think you'll get more bites than just perfect bugles.
I was going to say, I started, as soon as deer season got over this year, I started working with calls, and it took me a little while to get the diaphragm thing figured out, but I had tried a number of the Phelps ones, and the Maverick one was the one that literally, like, amazing, because I guess I was putting a lot of air through, and that one really handles a lot of air. That's kind of my natural thing. But and then I got that before I got the bugle, and I got the V2, and the first time I did, I was like, I thought, because I never could put my arms around, like, okay, how does the diaphragm work with the bugle? And I just did it once, and it was like, holy crap, that's kind of easy. You know, now the people that live around me hate me, but luckily I don't have too many neighbors, but the ones that do give me the sideways when I'm out there in the yard jamming, working on my bugles. Cause my wife's like, mostly I have to do it in the truck. You know, she's not a big fan of it. It's super loud. My dog goes nuts when I do it.
Oh yeah. Yeah. My wife, you'd think she'd be used to it after all these years, but she don't like it too much. She just eyes and be like, do you have to do that in the house? I'm like, I'm working. You're I'm like, at work right now.
Yeah. At least you can say it's work, right? Yeah. I'm a champion elk caller, and this is work. So I have no excuse. None. My wife's like, that's how long away? Like 6 months? I'm like, yeah, but come on. Like, I got to be decent at this.
My dog, he's he don't care about elk calls. He don't even like flinch.
Didn't flinch, huh?
But if I try to blow a duck call or an owl hooter or a wolf howler, oh man, he comes unglued. He starts barking and gets all riled up.
Yeah, mine gets riled up with the bugle, and then when I do the calf call with the diaphragm, my cat goes nuts. Not my cat, my daughter's cat, but that thing comes unglued.
I'll bet.
It's crazy. Well, listen, man, we're on an hour. I can't tell you how much time I appreciate it. Like, I could sit here and talk to you forever about it, but I want to be respectful of your time. I've got a YouTube short that's got, I don't know, like 800 or 900 views now that I just did like 7 or 8 days ago. And it was, I took somebody's advice and I did, like, I found this video on YouTube just of like I think there was like 4 or 5 cows and a couple calves that were just sitting there back and forth yapping at each other.
Yeah.
And I just started trying to mimic it with my diaphragm. And then I did a short where it was like, they were on one side, I was on the other side, and they would do one and I would do one. They would do one and I would do one. And I was like, I'm getting decent at this. So that's what I put on YouTube, and it got a lot of views. But that was that Maverick. That's a great call. Like, I love that call.
Oh, yeah, that's great. Yeah, good. Yeah, when I designed that, I was very selfish. And I'm like, well, I'm going to make this thing for me. I wanted to do everything that I could possibly want it to do, but nobody else will probably like it.
It
probably won't even sell. You know, this will probably be for just advanced callers. But the crazy part is, like noob callers, like brand new callers, they like it. And one thing I've kind of learned after, you know, teaching a lot of folks on how to use calls is a lot of new callers have no point of reference on how hard to blow a call. So one person thinks, man, I have to blow this thing with all my might because an elk's a big, loud creature. And another person just doesn't have the lung capacity or the wherewithal to blow that hard. So what I found is, like, there's a lot of new people that do like the call. And some of them will even say, you know, they first got into it, they really liked it, but once they kind of learned how to control their calls, they end up liking a couple of the others a little better, just because they finally learned how to get that their air pressure control better.
I actually found that I feel like I'm pretty new at it, but I feel like I can control that call a lot better than, like, I had tried 4 or 5 of the other ones. And I think they were all lighter, you know, they were labeled as beginner calls.
Yeah.
And I had a lot more difficulty controlling those. And when I tried the Maverick, I was like, all of a sudden I could hit all the different ranges. I could, you know, hit a much higher pitch than I could with the other ones. I felt like it was a lot more controllable than a bunch of the other ones I tried. Now, like you said, I have no point of reference, but like when I put that in, it was just kind of natural. I was like, oh yeah, this is the right one.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's why we make so many different ones, is just because everybody's so different, you know. And it doesn't matter on body size or anything. Like, there's a little girl who's like 14 years old that can blow that Maverick like better than most men. and then there's great big dudes that they don't like that Maverick at all. They like, you know, some of the real thin latex stuff. Mm-hmm. So you just never know. So it's cool to have something for everybody.
Yeah. Well, y'all make a great product. I love it. And I can't wait to get out there this fall and enjoy, you know, what you guys are blessed to live with every year. So I really appreciate you taking the time to visit with me today, man.
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to get on here and happy to talk hunting, man. I love it.
Yeah. Appreciate it, brother. Thank you so much.
Yep. Anytime.